The death toll from Monday's powerful earthquake in Turkey and Syria rises to above 5,000. Search and rescue operations going on. Iran unveils an underground air force base that's capable of storing and operating fighter jets, bombers, and drones. And France witnessing a third wave of nationwide rallies and walkouts amid growing anger at the government's pension reform plan. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan declaring a three-month state of emergency in 10 worst-hit cities after the Monday quakes devastated southern Turkey and northern Syria.
In order to ensure that search and rescue operations and the works in the aftermath are carried out quickly, we have decided to declare a state of emergency based on Article 119 of the Constitution. We will complete the processes rapidly in the presidency and parliament with regard to this decision taken for the 10 cities that suffered from the earthquake, and it'll last for 3 months.
Erdogan also unveiled a plan to send more than 50,000 aid workers to what are called a disaster zone. The announcement came as the death toll from two earthquakes measuring 7.8 and 7.5 on the Richter scale keeps rising. Nearly 3,550 people have been confirmed dead in Turkey. South across the border in Syria, fatalities standing at over 1,700 with thousands of people injured. Meantime, the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, says that thousands of children may have been killed. Rescuers are racing against time and braving extreme weather to find possible survivors. The World Health Organization has warned that up to 23 million people could be affected by earthquakes in Turkey and Syria.
Potentially 23 million people are exposed, including around 5 million vulnerable populations, including more than 350,000 older people, 1.4 million children. Civilian infrastructure and potentially health infrastructure have been damaged across the affected region, mainly in Turkey and northwest Syria. Besides massive destruction, the road access in many areas is disrupted inside Turkey and across the border inside northwest Syria.
The WHO says it's mobilized emergency supplies and activated a network of emergency medical teams to provide essential health care to the injured and the most vulnerable. Search and rescue teams have also been dispatched to Turkey and Syria from countries like Germany, Algeria, Mexico, and Italy. Pledges of assistance have been made by many European, Asian, and North American countries, too. Devastating quakes had their epicenter in southern Turkey. They also ravaged northern Syria. The affected regions in the two countries have experienced dozens of aftershocks since early Monday. All right, staying with the same story, Iran sending its aid to Syria to help the victims of the deadly quakes in the country's northern region. An Iranian plane carrying 45 tons of supplies has arrived in capital Damascus. Tehran had earlier expressed readiness to send relief aid to both Turkey and Syria. Many governments in Europe, Asia, and North America have made aid pledges, Russia saying its 300 military personnel deployed to Syria are already helping with clear-up efforts. The European Union says its member states have mobilized 27 search and rescue teams for Turkey. India has sent a second plane carrying disaster response personnel, medical staff, and equipment to help with operations in Turkey. Our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, joined us a short while ago, and he told us the latest about the situation in quake-hit areas.
The death toll reached 1,600 people killed as a result of the earthquake. This is in both government-held areas and terrorist-held areas, Idlib and its surroundings. Search and rescue operations continue, however, and unfortunately, chances are decreasing for finding people alive under the rubble now that it has been over a day and a half since the earthquake first hit those areas, especially in Aleppo and Latakia, and also with the lack of necessary equipment. And here I have to point out to what the head of the Syrian Arab Red Crescent said in a press conference just a while ago. He called for lifting economic sanctions on Syria so that necessary equipment, bulldozers, and all necessary needs required can reach here to the country so that they can actually do better job and their efforts would be more fruitful in rescuing the people. Also, what is important to say is that more humanitarian aid and assistance is coming to the country.
A Palestinian is holding a funeral for a teenager who got killed due to the injuries that he suffered in an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank. The 17-year-old Hamza Amjad al-Ashgar was shot in the face during a raid on a Nablus neighborhood earlier today. Hamas resistance movement has slammed the violence, warning the regime over persistence in its crimes. Israeli troops also killed five members of the movement in the West Bank city of Jericho on Monday. The regime has intensified cracking down on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, claiming the lives of 44 people in just more than a month. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has arrived in Russia to take part in the fifth round of the Moscow format consultations on Afghanistan. Upon arrival, Vice Admiral Ali Champani said that the regional forum will focus on the political, economic, and security developments in Afghanistan. Champani said that the aim is to prevent a new crisis in the region. He blamed foreign meddling and occupation for the current problems in Afghanistan. The regional security meetings were established by an initiative of the Islamic Republic in 2018. Champagne also talked about Tehran-Moscow relations. He said the ties with Russia are expanding in the fields of economy, defense, and security. He noted that further development of bilateral ties requires adherence to the roadmap previously agreed to by leaders of both countries. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has wrapped up his week-long visit to Latin American countries. In his meetings, the top diplomat discussed ways to enhance Tehran's cooperation with countries like Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is on the final leg of his trip to Latin America, where he has met with a number of high-ranking officials in an effort to boost bilateral and multilateral relations. Cuba was the latest destination of Amir Abdollahian, where he met with Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel. During the meeting, they discussed matters of mutual interest at bilateral and international levels. The top Iranian diplomat voiced his country's categorical support for Havana while condemning sanctions on Cuba and foreign intervention in its internal affairs. Díaz-Canel, for his part, said despite all the existing pressures, Cuba is determined to cooperate with friendly countries and work with them to eliminate obstacles and challenges lying ahead. The Cuban president criticized U.S. unilateralism and said that his country has earned political independence at a high price and would preserve it. Amir Abdollahian also met with his Cuban counterpart, Bruno Rodriguez Parilla. Both diplomats wrapped the sanctions policy against others, including Iran and several South American countries, saying such a policy is doomed to fail. Before Cuba, the top Iranian diplomat paid a visit to Venezuela, which is maintaining strong bilateral relations with Tehran. During a meeting between Amir Abdollahian and Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the two sides discussed ways to strengthen cooperation further in various fields, including energy. They also called for heightened influence in the face of Western and Bush. Maduro also pointed to common challenges being faced by Venezuela and Iran. Amir Abdollahian also traveled to Nicaragua as part of his Latin American trip. In a meeting with President Daniel Ortega, he condemned unlawful sanctions imposed by the U.S. and certain Western countries on Iranian individuals and entities. He stressed, however, that the Islamic Republic had managed to move forward despite coercive measures designed to stop the country's progress. Amir Abdollahian voiced Tehran's eagerness for closer cooperation in various fields, saying Iran sets no limits to the promotion of cooperation with Nicaragua. Ortega, for his part, highlighted shared concerns of Tehran and Managua. He said that the two countries have a common enemy, adding that what Iran fought and defeated in 1979 was the same Nicaraguans rose up against in the same year.
The Latin American visit by Iran's foreign minister highlights the need for countries like Iran, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, and even Brazil to form an alliance to stand against U.S. hegemony and unilateralism. Latin American countries aren't the only ones. Even many African nations are also eager to enhance their ties with the East, countries like Iran, Russia, and China.
Amir Abdullahian's visit to Latin America puts under the spotlight the significance of his meeting with officials there. One of the most important points highlighted by almost all leaders was that the ongoing developments in Latin America and elsewhere in the world are creating new opportunities for multilateralism. That was particularly underlined by the top Iranian diplomat, who dismissed unilateralism as an obsolete doctrine on the global stage. He stressed that unilateralism cannot respond to developments and changes taking place worldwide. In the case of Iran and Venezuela, the officials of the two OPEC members found a common ground to solidify their relations to deal with a common enemy, the United States, which has come up with crippling sanctions against them for years. Standing against the U.S. and Western imperialism was another topic of discussion during the Iranian officials' visit. That was underscored in Daniel Ortega's comments, where he said the enemies of global peace and tranquility have maintained their imperialistic policies and considered the whole world, not just Latin America, as their backyard. Ortega, however, expressed hope that imperialism cannot last any longer. On sanctions, Latin American leaders echoed the stance of the Iranian foreign minister, who called such measures a terrorist threat being used by imperial powers as leverage. They stressed the need for boosting cooperation in trade and technology, among other things, to overcome those curbs. It seems that shared challenges have brought these countries together to push against U.S. hegemony. And what could make a difference? Moving away from the U.S. dollar, establishing a common currency, enhancing bilateral and multilateral trade. It seems that an oriental shift is largely taking place in today's world. That is visible in countries on the African continent that are trying to enhance ties with the East, namely Russia and China, and Latin American nations that are standing firm against U.S. unilateralism. All these point to their rejection of Western hegemony.
The Iranian army has unveiled its first underground air force base as part of the country's detailed plans to develop subterranean military bases. Dubbed Oghab 44, the base is capable of storing and operating fighter jets, bombers, and drones. It consists of different parts, including alert area, command posts, warplane hangars, as well as repair and maintenance depots. The base has been constructed with high safety standards and can be used for surprise aerial operations. Oghab 44 is one of Iran's several tactical underground air force bases that have been constructed across the nation in recent years. The Air Force unveiled an underground facility dubbed Drone Base 313 last year, too. Russia has once again accused the United States and its Western allies of trying to prolong the war in Ukraine by supplying Kyiv with lethal weapons.
The U.S. and its allies are trying to drag out the conflict as much as possible. To do this, they have started supplying heavy offensive weapons, openly urging Ukraine to seize our territories. In fact, such steps are dragging NATO countries into the conflict and could lead to an unpredictable level of escalation.
The Russian Defense Ministry has repeatedly warned the U.S.-led NATO against playing a direct role in the Ukraine conflict. Western governments, however, have defied the warnings and keep sending arms and munitions to Ukraine to help it fight Russia. The U.S. has alone shipped more than $20 billion worth of arms to Ukraine since the war began in early 2022. Just last week, Washington announced another $2 billion worth of military aid that's expected to include longer-range missiles. Now, for now, much of the fighting in Ukraine is focusing around the eastern towns of Bakhmut and Vuhledar. The Russian Defense Ministry says the forces are advancing with success in areas around the two towns. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has pledged to expand military drills and beef up his country's war readiness. Kim was speaking at a meeting of the Central Military Commission of the ruling Workers' Party. Officials discussed major military and political tasks for this year. North Korea is expected to stage a military parade on Wednesday to mark the founding anniversary of its armed forces. Tensions have been rising on the Korean Peninsula in recent months. Last week, Pyongyang condemned the drills jointly by the U.S., South Korea, and Japan. North Korea says the war games have reached, quote, an extreme red line and threaten to turn the Korean Peninsula into a war zone. Washington has vowed to deploy more aircraft carriers and long-range bombers to the region to counter North Korea's weapons development. Now, in France, workers have launched a third wave of mass rallies and walkouts against the government's retirement plan that requires them to work longer to qualify for a full pension. Workers across multiple sectors have gone on a strike countrywide, causing disruptions to train services and stopping refinery deliveries. Many school classes have also been canceled. Demonstrators hit the streets again after two similar protest actions called by unions in January. The pension plans are now being discussed by the parliament. They include a hike in the retirement age by 2 years. Opposition MPs from across the political spectrum have strongly criticized the reforms.
Of course, I think that the French are right to protest and call on them to demonstrate on Tuesday the 7th and next Saturday, because it's the only to counter the government. It's about the numbers, about having as big as a strike as possible and as much people taking action as possible, so that we can oppose the government until the end and until it yields. That's the point.
During a meeting at the National Assembly, cabinet ministers were booed as they struggled to defend the changes to the retirement age. The government says that a reform aims to lift the pension system out of deficit by 2030 by finding around 18 billion euros in annual savings. But critics argue that the money can be found elsewhere, proposing higher taxes on the rich. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Epic, glory, honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy. See the world through IRIB English Radio, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we briefly discussed Imam Khomeini's return from Paris to Iran a few days after the Shah's escape from the country. Today, we are going to relate the story of his arrival in Iran. After 14 years of exile, Imam Khomeini arrived in Iran on February 2, 1979. The companions of Imam were very concerned and restless as they thought of the possibility of terrorist attempts or bombing plots against the Imam during the trip. Although the last prime minister of the regime, Shapur Bakhtiar, had agreed with the landing of the Air France flight in Tehran, there were rumors among people of a conspiracy to assassinate the Imam. Some said that the airplane would explode in the air. Others spoke of the likelihood of changing the course of the airplane and abducting the Imam. However, people in the country were looking at the sky, waiting for Imam Khomeini's flight to appear. The streets leading to Mehrabad Airport were full of millions of lovers who had gathered enthusiastically to welcome their beloved leader. Hundreds of stands were set up to distribute sweets and candies among people. Yet, the only face which was unchanged and serene was the face of Imam Khomeini, as he was sitting in the airplane in complete calm. He was so calm that when a reporter asked him of his feeling in those moments, he only answered, "Nothing." This was so amazing that the reporter didn't ask any other question. Nevertheless, the Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, was very worried and preoccupied with the thought of Imam's healthy flight to Iran. She would think if the regime would let him free or would arrest and imprison him. Would the Imam's security be guaranteed during the flight? Would he be secure at the airport and his transfer from the airport to the place of his speech? Would his life be guaranteed among the swarming population in Behesht-e-Zahra Cemetery? Where would be his place of residence? These and scores of other thoughts had occupied the mind of the Imam's wife. When the news of Imam Khomeini's health reached his wife in Paris, she sighed in relief and thanked God for this great bounty. After his arrival in Iran and residing at Alavi School, Imam Khomeini asked Ayatollah Mutahhari to make the preparations for his wife's return to the country. Thus, 2 days later, the lady left Paris for Tehran. In the first days, the Imam's wife was residing at a different place due to the big number of people who came to visit the Imam. At first, women were not allowed to visit the Imam. But soon, Imam Khomeini asked those in charge to determine certain days for women's visit. Therefore, the Imam and his wife could meet one another in special intervals. In view of this, many ladies, as soon as getting informed of Ms. Saghafi's residence, eagerly rushed to visit her. Imam Khomeini's daughter, Zahra Mustafavi, says in this regard, "When my mother resided in this house and the locals and other women were informed of her presence, rushed to meet her. My mother would sit on a bench and the visitors would come in a long queue to greet and meet her. Some of them who were closer relatives or old friends of the lady, would sit in the room for formal reception, and some of them would stay for lunch or dinner. My mother's warm welcome and smile was very memorable for all who met her. Dear listeners, on February 9th, just 3 days before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, a group of the Air Force officers came to Imam Khomeini's residence as a sign of their allegiance to him. Indeed, it was as a parade before the Imam. This parade was registered by Hossein Partovi, the skilled photographer, who took the photo from the back of the officers, not to be recognized by the agents of the regime. The photo of the Air Force officers was published on Kayhan newspaper. This once more revived the hope of victory in the hearts of the people, while the puppet premier of the regime, Shapur Bakhtiar, was scared and panicked. When the newspaper was taken to the Imam's wife, she mentioned two important points. Firstly, the Prime Minister would no longer rely on the Air Force, and secondly, the photo was both artistic and epic. She even tried to estimate the number of the officers from the photo. The next day, a group of the Shah Special Guards attacked the Air Force officers to avenge their parade. The news of this move soon was spread everywhere, and people confronted the guards till the next morning. When the Imam's wife heard the people's support for the Air Force officers, she prayed so that all events would end in victory. Thank God, the Islamic Revolution triumphed and the enemies were frustrated.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We should have that willingness that even though we might have everything that we like, but if the time comes to move away, and to choose the path of challenges for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that is actually the true demonstration of what is known as taqwa. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Surah Hud, which is Surah number 11 of the Quran, in series of stories that he talks about the previous nations, ending with the story of Nuh alayhi salam and the flood, and how he rescued him and his few number of his followers. Then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says to the Prophet, and through him he is giving the message to us, where he says, Fastubir, maintain patience, فَإِنَّ الْآقِبَةَ لِلْمُتَّقِينَ, because the eventual victory belongs to those who are muttaqeen and pious. And this is where we see that taqwa becomes very important. And not only for men, This is equally a quality which should be there even among believing women. When we look at the example of Zainab bint Ali, salawatullah alayhuma, Zainab indeed is a symbol of sabr and taqwa. In this ayat, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, فَاصْبِرْ إِنَّ الْآقِبَةَ لِلْمُتَّقِينَ. So sabr and taqwa go hand in hand. And you will see both these qualities at a higher level when we look at the example of Zainab. She was, after all, you know, the blessed with best examples of taqwa in her own family and in the environment in which she came to this dunya. And that is the blessing of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You know, sometimes I describe that when she was born and when she opened her eyes, the first person that she sees is the Masuma mother. She looks up, it is the infallible father. Then she looks at the two siblings, the brothers, they are also Masum. The grandfather also comes, who is also Masum. So she is surrounded with those who are Masum and infallible. And that environment of the family definitely has an impact. And although I talked about this issue of only those who are were Masum, we had to realize that this is the reality, that the family environment, the example and role model provided by the family members to the children, they are very crucial in the upbringing of the children. Look at the people in the extended family. When you look at the life of Bibi Zainab, although she had not seen Bibi Khadija, but after all, you know, that genetic, you know, connection is there. And the character builds in that way also. And if you look at the example of Khadija salawatullah alayha, I'm sure when Bibi Fatima would be talking to Zainab about her mother, those examples would come up. Because if you look at her life, Bibi Khadija, basically she was the wealthiest woman in Mecca. But although she was rich and affluent, she was not mesmerized by wealth. For her, the true value in a human being was in akhlaq. And that is where we see that when the issue of marriage came up, she did not marry anyone who was affluent and rich. Her choice goes to Muhammad bin Abdullah. Why? Because of his honesty, because of his sidq and truthfulness, because of his akhlaq. And that was seen by the reports she got from the slaves who were working with the Prophet in this caravan which had gone on her behalf to Syria. And this is where we realize that although she is there right in the middle of, you know, luxury and comfort and richness and affluence, but she is not influenced by that. She's above that. And if she wants to separate herself from it, it's not really a difficult thing. And so she marries the Prophet. 15 years of the marriage goes without any special event. But then when the Prophet becomes 40 years old, his mission starts. The Nabi now is also starting his risalat. And at that time, all historians, Shia and Sunni alike, when they talk about the first person to accept the message of Rasulullah, all of them say, without any exception, that it was Khadija salawatullah alayha. Not only that she adjusted to the new situation, she was a strong, you know, pillar of support for Rasulullah in this mission. Even when the opposition started, and it's not that when Islam started, you know, things were still normal like before, no. Challenges started. Mushrikeen started opposing the Prophet, you know, labeling him in different ways, trying to bribe him. Eventually, they went to, you know, higher level, escalating their opposition. They went to Abu Talib and said, you know, because of him, we don't touch him. So now you have to make a choice. So even Abu Talib is now being put in a situation of making a choice. And yet Muslims still doubt whether he was a Muslim or not. And he was given a choice. Either you separate yourself from him, so then we can deal with him the way we want and you wouldn't interfere, or we are going to impose socio-economic boycott on the entire Banu Hashim clan. And what does Abu Talib do? He says, I don't care about you because I believe in the message of my nephew. And he took the entire Banu Hashim family, extended family, to a property he had outside Mecca, which is known as Sha'be Abi Talib, an open, you know, valley area. And he's 3 years they spent there. Only during the 4 months, which were considered to be holy and sacred months, even for the mushrikeen before Islam, as Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Quran talks about it, when he talks about Al-Ashhurul Huram, Rajab, Zulqa'da, Zulhijjah, and Muharram. It's only during that time that they were able to come to the city, you know, buy some necessities. Otherwise, other than that, their life was in danger if they left their own, you know, area. Sometimes relatives of Khadija would take grain, put it on the camel, and just pretend that they are going somewhere else. And once they reach close to that valley, they would let the camels, you know, just go direct by themselves to that area. Sometimes they would reach there, sometimes not. Sometimes they will be intercepted by the agents and the spies of the mushrikeen. And so it was, even food-wise, things were not easy. But those 3 years, you never hear even a single report saying that Khadija ever complained to Rasulullah. Never ever saying that, you know, I had such a comfortable life. What have I got myself into it? No. Because she was a true mu'minah. She was an example for us. And the highest level of taqwa, where when the time came to make the choice, she decided to leave the comfort and the affluence for the suffering that she went through during the Sha'bi Abi Talib. And it had an impact on her physically. Because we see, as soon as the boycott was then, you know, canceled, and there is a whole story behind it, when they came back to Mecca, within few months, Khadija and then Abu Talib both passed away. Because of the suffering that they had through during those 3 years. And this is where we see the example of taqwa in the extended family of Zainab binti Ali, in the form of a lady by the name of Khadija, salawatullah alayha.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Nikki Haley, a former United Nations ambassador and governor of South Carolina, is planning to announce a presidential run. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Washington Post has covered this story and tells us more. Nikki Haley, a former United Nations ambassador and governor of South Carolina, is planning to announce that she will run for president, positioning herself to be the first declared Republican challenger to Donald Trump, at a time when other prospective candidates have slowed their moves. Nikki Haley could release a video signaling her decision as soon as this week, a strategy as described by multiple people briefed on the plans who spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to talk publicly, intended to drive attendance and enthusiasm for an in-person announcement event in the coming weeks. Haley plans to officially announce her run in Charleston, South Carolina, on 15th of February, according to one person briefed on the plans, a date first reported by the Post and Courier newspaper in Charleston, South Carolina. Some political advisers have been relocating to the Charleston area for the campaign. Nikki Haley's decision to lean into the race bucks the more cautious strategy adopted by most other potential candidates who have decided there is no need to rush their preparations. Advisers to these Republicans, many of whom spoke on condition of anonymity, described private conversations, said there is a wariness about becoming an early target of former President Donald Trump. Some of the advisers also voiced hope that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who has made preliminary moves towards the run, faces early scrutiny because of his high national polling, scrutiny that could work to their advantage. They added that there is a general sense in their circles that there is enough time to learn more about how the race will play out and still attract donors, get on ballots and build campaign infrastructure. There's no benefit to being in early, said David Urban, a former Trump advisor who is friendly with multiple would-be 2024 candidates. Urban added, you don't want to be in the ring getting banged on by the former president in a one-on-one. There's no reason anyone has to get in right now. There's no urgency for anyone. Everyone is sitting and waiting. Much of the consequential action in the race so far has taken place in private conversations and strategy sessions rather than early state barnstorms, such as methodical preparation by aides to former Vice President Mike Pence and Ron DeSantis advisors behind-the-scenes moves to identify potential staff and plan travel. Even Donald Trump has moved slowly after his early announcement. The former president hit the trail this past week for the first time since launching his campaign in November, promising a campaign about the future and about issues, even as he returned to some old grievances, falsely telling Republicans in New Hampshire that he won two general elections, a reference to his claims of victory in 2020. Some Republican leaders have urged the party to move on and view the former president as politically weakened after disappointing midterm elections in which Donald Trump's endorsed candidates lost key races. One question that looms over the jockeying for position is where wealthy Republican donors will decide to put their money. Some major donors who were with Donald Trump in 2020 have not yet committed to his re-election, even after entreaties from Donald Trump advisers. As one advisor to a major GOP donor put it, "I don't think anybody in our world has picked a horse yet." CBS News has also covered this story and tells us more. Nikki Haley, a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and South Carolina governor, is expected to officially announce her 2024 presidential run on 15th of February in Charleston, South Carolina, according to two South Carolina Republicans familiar with her plans. Nikki Haley would become the first Republican candidate to join former President Donald Trump in the Republican presidential primary. Haley's last hint at a 2024 run came earlier this month during a Fox News interview in which she called for generational change when looking at the future of the country. "I don't think you need to be 80 years old to be a leader in Washington, D.C., the 51-year-old Nikki Haley said. "I think we need a younger generation to come in, step up, and really start fixing things." When you're looking at a run for president, you look at two things, Haley added. You first look at, does the current situation push for new leadership? The second question is, am I that person and could be that, and could I be that new leader? So do I think I could be that leader? Yes, but we're still working through things and we'll figure it out. I've never lost a race. I said that then. I still say it now. I'm not going to lose now. In the 2022 midterm election cycle, though her Stand for America PAC, Nikki Haley campaigned for Republicans up and down the ticket and took trips to Iowa, to New Hampshire, and to Nevada, all early presidential primary states. She was also a close surrogate on the trail of Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin and Senate candidates Dr. Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania and Herschel Walker in Georgia. Nikki Haley has consistently polled third or fourth in early 2024 GOP primary surveys. In a Trafalgar Group poll in late January of South Carolina primary voters, Nikki Haley was placed fourth and got 11.6% of the vote in a field that included Donald Trump, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, South Carolina Governor Tim Scott, former Vice President Mike Pence, and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Tim Scott, another potential 2024 contender from the Palmetto State, is traveling to Iowa for the Polk County Republican Party's annual Lincoln Dinner in late February. Nikki Haley stepped from the governor's office to the international stage at the United Nations, rounding out credentials that would prepare her for a campaign like this. "It's like a countdown at NASA, T-minus 2 weeks and counting," said Dave Wilson, president of the Christian nonprofit Palmetto Family Council. Nikki Haley notched one symbolic win against Donald Trump last year in the primary for South Carolina's 1st congressional district when Haley backed Representative Nancy Mace. Nancy Mace defeated Donald Trump's endorsed candidate, former Representative Katie Arrington, by about 9 percentage points. Trump told reporters traveling with him on Saturday to South Carolina for a campaign stop that Nikki Haley had reached out to her ex-boss to inform him that she was considering running for the White House. "She called me and said she'd like to consider it, and I said, 'You should do it,'" Trump recounted. "I talked to her for a little while. I said, 'Look, you know, go by your heart if you want to run.'" Nikki Haley, a South Carolina native who was the first female and Indian American governor in state history, told the Associated Press in April of 2021 that she would not challenge Donald Trump if he decided to run again. Trump nominated Haley for the United Nations ambassadorship after his win in 2016. "I would not run if President Trump ran, and I would talk to him about it," Nikki Haley said at the time. But since then, she has suggested repeatedly that she is seriously considering a run. The former South Carolina governor told Fox News Channel that her comments about not running against Donald Trump were made before some perceived flaws of President Joe Biden's administration, such as the withdrawal from Afghanistan and a dramatic rise in inflation.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with a number of eulogists and religious poets in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on January 12, 2023. The meeting took place one day before the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha. Some songs bring depression. They make people depressed. They discourage people. They are different. Some songs lead people towards sins. Many of the songs that are set to instrumental music are like this. Each of these songs has some music at the start of it that inspires the singer with the song. These songs are often not appropriate. We need to be careful about the poems we recite, the songs we sing, and the elegies we read, whether they are about a tragedy or when we beat our chest, or whether it is sung in praise. We need to make sure we do not combine them with these things. This is an important point to note. I urge you to pay attention to this. Therefore, the content must be good. The structure of the poem should be good. The framework, body, appearance of the poem must be good. This will raise your audience's level of thinking.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If you put the best topics in a weak poem and read it, its effect will be greatly reduced. Allow your audience's mind to become accustomed to rich literature. This will help the intellectual growth of the society. In a similar meeting a few years ago, I referred to some of Sa'ib's ghazals, which were not ghazals on love. They were ghazals on wisdom, and they were filled with wisdom. The poetry is extremely rich and beautiful. It is good to look for those poems and read them. Thankfully, some poets write some very good poems in this field. In addition to gaining understanding in elegies, there is also stirring of emotions. This is also an important point. There is gaining understanding. This means that you are teaching people with the poem you are reciting. Many of the things we learn are from the elegies that elegists recite, things that we have already told others many times in a simple language. But when the elegist or eulogist recites the same thing with a good voice and a good melody, it is as though we are hearing, understanding, and learning something new.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Visit us at parstoday.ir/pn.